Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Before we begin our conversation with Elvis Mitchell, I want to thank everyone who contributed to WEAA during their fund drive in the last week. It was a great success, and do appreciate everybody showing their support for this public radio station. And want to encourage you all now to go to WEAA.org, because we fell a tad short. We can make it up. You can do it at WEAA.org and show your support for WEAA, the voice of the community. Elvis Mitchell is our guest in this hour. He is a former film critic for the New York Times, host of KCRW's The Treatment, producer of the documentary series The Blacklist, Volumes 1 and 2. Volume 1 was a recipient of the NAACP Image Award for Best Documentary. Volume 2 will be screened tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Brown Center at MICA as part of the OSI Baltimore series in Talking About Race. Elvis Mitchell will be there, along with co-creator of the film, Timothy Greenfield Sanders, to introduce the film and take your questions. You can go to osi-baltimore.org for more information. And join us here now at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Thanks.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here. And I've been an admirer of your work for a long, long time. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, Mark, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking.
I'm curious about this 1 and 2. I watched 2 last night. I was just between RZA and Charlie Pride. I love those two spectrums. We'll come to that in a minute.
I mean, yeah. We're trying to confound it as much as possible. So you think, wait a second now. What, no jazz? No gospel? Charlie Pride?
You know, Charlie Pride, though, you know, people used to love, when I was a younger man in the 60s, to diss Charlie Pride.
Yeah. In fact, he talks about that a little bit in the film, as you know, mm-hmm. even the kind of the lack of welcome he got from the country music establishment. And for me, when we were putting these goals together, one of the goals was to confound the kind of monolithic cultural perception of the African-American community, you know. The fact is that Charlie Pride is the second largest selling artist in the history of RCA Records, right behind Elvis Presley.
Isn't that amazing?
yes, completely amazing. And I just knew that to do something like that, to get him and to have the first volume start with Slash, is to get people thinking, wait, what's going on here? Oh, I get it.
Before I don't want to jump too far ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about the whole concept between Blacklist Volume 1 that was been out and now this in Volume 2 that came out in February. Let's talk about the conceptually how this began and what this was all meant for you.
First of all, let me say, as a longtime public radio person, that I would encourage people to make sure they support the station, because this is how places like this live. You know, we need the support of the community, and I'm sure you get a lot of listener support, but the pledge support is important too, so I just wanted to let people know I second that.
Thank you very much.
And, oh, completely my pleasure. And, the difference is between the two volumes, first of all, we didn't think to call this Volume 1 until HBO said, well, we're a little concerned about just calling it The Blacklist, because what people say, well, why is this guy on and not this guy? Why is this woman on and why isn't she on? And I said, well, if anybody thinks this is supposed to encompass the entire black experience in 90 minutes, I'm happy to meet that person. Then the response was, well, can we call it work in progress? But everybody knew if you say work in progress, that means that people will think it's not finished. So I just said, well, why don't we call it Volume 1? Not realizing, of course, that begs for a Volume 2.
And they were done separately at different times?
Yes, separately at different times. We came up with the idea for the first one really around, the fall of 06. Did a couple of test interviews, which ended up in the film. First was Thelma Golden at the Studio Museum in Harlem. And the second was Timothy's old friend, Toni Morrison. And just getting those two people on board was enough to have a few of Timothy's friends come on and put money into the film, betting that we could find a place for it. And I knew we could get the film into the Sundance Film Festival. What happened was the world started to change as we were making the films, and mm-hmm. nobody could have predicted that there would be a credible African-American candidate for president, let alone an electable candidate for African-American.
Let alone a black president of the United States of America. It is amazing.
I didn't even want it. This is a syllogism. Credible, electable. Elected.
You know, who was
exactly. And so as this was happening, suddenly the world started to change. And more and more people start to come on board, I was able to talk to a couple people I know, Susan Lloyd Parks, the playwright, and Chris Rock and Keenan Ivory Wayans, whom I'd known for a while. And it was kind of interesting for me that in the film, the people that people don't know make as big a splash as the people who are celebrated, which is kind of the point. For me, the films are about the African-American experience in the 21st century. You know, it's vast. It contains multitudes. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you, because you've seen both of the films, if you had a preference between the two.
Did I have a preference? They were. I really kind of enjoyed the second one in a way because of the folks that were in it. I mean, some of the people in the first one, you expected had to be there, you know? But when I saw Majora Carter, Susanna DePass, I fell in love with Valerie Montgomery Rice.
Isn't she great? Isn't she the greatest?
I mean, she was just amazing. Duval Patrick, what he said about the English language, which we'll talk about in a minute, and Maya Rudolph, I thought that was really important to put that in there, given all the folks who are genuinely kind of mixed race in America and struggle with being black and Jewish and black and whatever you are. And, of course, one of my all-time favorites, Madman Melvin Peebles. Van Peebles.
So you think that you like the second one a little bit better because of the mix of
yes.
people being interviewed?
Though I like them both a great deal. I think I like the second one a little better. I was really looking forward to it when I saw who was in there. Angela Davis, who said what I thought she was going to say, which was fine because I thought she was very powerful.
You were expecting the things that she said,
only because I've heard her before, and I
okay. Because I thought some of the stuff we got when we were talking about her brother. Because I grew up in Detroit,
right,
and saw the way her brother was ostracized by the Detroit Lions and the Cleveland Browns,
yes.
because of his politics, and that's not something she's really talked about much before. And I thought we were breaking a little ground with that one.
Maybe I should step backwards. The reason I say that because I'm from that period and I remember all that, and I remember.
Ah.
Angela very well, and I remember being at Soledad Prison the day the killings took place.
Oh my gosh!
And so I was so deeply into that maybe that's why I said what I said about Angela.
No, it was exciting for me because I kind of grew up watching her. I remember as a kid. There's this awful TV show called The FBI, which is the one
I remember that.
Terrible, yes, this terrible right-wing cardboard right. cop show.
Right.
But each episode ended with something that was kind of, I think, the precursor of America's Most Wanted, which they would end each episode with a real live clip focusing on the most wanted criminal in the country, the number one top criminal. And one week, it was Angela Davis. There was a celebration in my name. People were screaming. You know, everybody's calling everybody up. It was really exciting. And I mentioned this to her, and she just kind of went pale and said, oh, no, it was awful. If I had known that was going to happen, I would never have done what I did in the first place.
Yes.
And I was fascinated to hear her talk about being in the center of the maelstrom and just how also her entire family was radicalized, which I think is something that a lot of us have lost sight of. But your being there at Soledad when those things happened and the world changed is, gosh, where is your book, brother? When are you going to write this down?
I related to what she said about when you were there, you really did believe that you were going to make a revolution, that it was going to happen any day now. That was what, you know, that was part of what was happening at that moment, you know, and she was so symbolic of that. But before we lose ourselves here again, we're talking with Elvis Mitchell, of course, the former film critic for the New York Times and host of KCRW's The Treatment and producer of the documentary series Blacklist 1 and 2. Number 2 will be in Baltimore tomorrow night at the OSI Baltimore series talking about race. It'll be at the Brown Center at MICA. He will be there along with Timothy Greenfield Sanders to talk about the film. And the number here is 410-319-8888. And let me get a caller in here who's been waiting. She called in early. And Nicole in Reservoir Hill, you're on the air here. Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to do that to you, Zach. Go ahead. You're on the air, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I had to stick around after work just to hear this. I was so excited to hear that this was going to be the topic. I absolutely loved the Blacklist, both volumes 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And
there were so many
stories that like spoke to me in a way I didn't expect. Colin Powell, for example, I think I've been holding a lot of animosity about the Iraq war against him, and his piece really made me take another look at him and I guess give some forgiveness in my own heart for his role in all of that. I mean, he just came across as really human to me in a way that I think I had boxed him off so that he wasn't. I liked Chris Rock's point about his neighborhood and how in order to get there, you know, all the black people had to be the best in their category, whereas his neighbor was just a dentist. And I actually used that during the election season to kind of have a discussion with one of my white coworkers about just how different our worlds are. And I laughed. Just the other day, I laughed thinking about Governor Patrick's story about his daughter in the Four Seasons because...
I love that.
I mean, I came from humble beginnings, too, and I have a kid now who's just... She has no idea what it's like to want for anything, and for him to tell that story just made me laugh and think, you know, thank God I'm not the only one struggling with trying to raise, you know, a kid in a world where she's got stuff she didn't even know she wanted, you know. And my husband and I cracked up at Melvin Van Peebles' story about who was it, Earth, Wind, and Fire, this little poor group
right.
hanging out in the apartment. I loved these. I hope there'll be many more volumes.
Thank you so much, Nicole. We're talking about doing another volume, and all these things you talk about are just things that really excited me, too. I have to say, I had my, how best to put this, questions about Colin Powell, too. But I do remember in just doing the research and reading, and I did all the interviews. I'm off camera, thank God, probably. But that he is a fairly complex man, and I knew that he loved the play Pearly Victorious. And I asked him about that, and then he starts talking about Ossie Davis, and I said... I had mentioned to him that weird silence at the 2000 Republican National Convention when he talked about how important affirmative action was, and there was dead silence. And he says, no, there wasn't. I said, no, yes, there was. And he goes, no. I said, come on, I remember you were an LBJ supporter. And then he told that great story about being pulled over by the cop in Georgia with the LBJ sticker on the back of his Volkswagen. And, you know, I guess for me, the point of doing these films is certainly to show that our experience encompasses so much more, and there just tends to be still, even in this day, a reductionist look at the African-American experience, that you are this, this, and this, and this is the box in which you live, and it's important to show that everybody's experience is different, and the thing that they all have in common is that they're all, in their way, indomitable. They refuse to be stopped by anything.
By anything. Thank you so much for that call, Nicole. Glad you held on. She mentioned a couple of people in volume two here. Duval Patrick, I thought that he said a lot in his short time that you put him up. What you boiled it down to, he said a great deal. I mean, one was about the importance of the ability to use language. That was really interesting.
Well, yeah, because it's first of all, it sort of speaks against the concept of mere eloquence, which is the sort of thing that the rubric that's been thrown at both him and the president. And there's much more to it than that. There's the force of idea behind those words and how those ideas are applied and how conscious he is of that. And that there is a tradition of that, I think, in this country for African Americans, and especially those in public discourse, who really have to be measured and thoughtful, but also understand the weight of those words and then how to apply them, and that none of these things are arrived at casually. And I was really impressed by the way he used that, and that important part of that speech, you know, that words matter, because that's a key part from a speech he gave that also then-Senator Obama used in the speech, too, to show that it wasn't just specific to him but to a lot of African-American politicians.
And also what he said there, when he said how life as a child taught him the American dream was real, it made me think, because I was after the second hour was done, I was sitting on the couch with Valerie, we were watching it, and I was saying, you know, this might be the subtext for the entire two volumes, that – of all the communities in America, the black community in America has held onto this American dream through slavery and through everything else. I mean, and that to me was like this, I felt like a powerful subtext of everything that's going on here in these two volumes.
Oh, that's completely, thank you for noting that, Mark. That's really what the film is, the films are. Because people will ask me, well, why is it all African Americans? And I say, because we have built a culture based on negativity and degradation and deprivation, and turned all those things that we were denied into positives, that we weren't slowed by that at all. We built cultures out of nothing. I mean, if you look at people in the UK, they tend to come from other countries. You know, they know where they're from. They know their family cultures. They know the history of their countries and those traditions. We don't have that. We built traditions out of nothing, traditions that became part of the foundation upon which this country is built. And I think if anything shows how the fact the fact that we can use what was hurled against us and turn that into a way to achieve a dream is, I think, a singular kind of experience in civilized culture. And it's the reason the film also called The Blacklist, because I just thought I've grown up as an African American. You hear black used as a negative in almost every case. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was time in the 21st century to reclaim that in the way that so much black history, black culture has been about reclamation.
There's so many people that said so much in these. Now, unfortunately, the clips we have, the HBO sent us clips from Volume 1, not Volume 2, but we're going to play some of those anyway.
Well, see, this whets the appetite for Volume 2.
That's exactly what it does. It whets the appetite. And if we talk, Lawrence Fishburne in this piece was also just fascinating. I've never heard him say what he said there, which was that, and it's something I could see exploring in a much greater depth with him at some point, somebody, is that Boys in the Hood, after this young kid came up to him, he was made to realize that he was being seen as the father of a generation for young men who didn't have a father.
Well, yeah, not only that, but he also was attracted to those kind of roles in some way that he hadn't really articulated before, because in him as well, there's also this kind of father hunger, because you go without having a father in the household. So he made himself into this archetype that was missing from his own life. And I just thought that was really a remarkable thing to get from him. And also, he was one of the people who saw Volume 1 and wanted to be involved in a second film, which is, I think, maybe one of the big differences, too. When we were making the first film, we had no idea what it was going to be. It was kind of this inchoate thing that was forming itself with each and every vignette interview that we shot. And nobody knew what it was going to be until it was finished and it started to play. And then we started to get people reacting to it. And when Fish called up and said he wanted to be a part of this, you see the idea of somebody who suddenly shows up with his A game rather than us finding these little nuggets. And it was really kind of interesting, too, because it's that thing that Balzac talks about love when it's new and strange. And that first time out, it was kind of like falling in love. And when I see Volume 1 now, and it does turn up every once in a while on HBO, I'll be in a hotel room and it'll just turn up and I'll watch it. It kind of feels like it doesn't belong to me anymore. You know, it feels like it belongs to the ages now. And if there's a difference between the two volumes, I think is that in Volume 1, a lot of people are talking about their entire lives and careers, and a lot of those interviews feel like summings up.
Mm-hmm.
And Volume 2 is less summation and more about people still in the thick of these things, people who are still, you know, piloting their own courses, from T.D. Jakes to Valerie Montgomery Rice to even Melvin Van Peebles, who still talks about things in the present. He doesn't look back. And I feel like it's Volume 2 is both intimate and has a kind of a heat. And the first one feels like a kind of a valedictory to me.
That's an interesting way to put it. And it's also, I think, that that number two was, everything was such a had a positive spin, in the sense that let's look for some, you know, it's like a friend of mine said the other day, who came here for a meeting of 100 black men. He's he's an actor, he's African-American, he was in the Army for 20 years, went from private to major, then he became an actor and a very peaceful man. And he said he was getting sick and tired of seeing all the stats. He said, we all know the stats. We know how terrible they are for young black men. I want to start talking about what we do that made our lives powerful, to bring positive images out for people to grab a hold of, so we can have a different kind of conversation. And in some senses, that was another tone that went through Blacklist 2.
Well, yeah, although I think it really applies to both films, because as we were putting this together, what I said was, and forgive me for putting it this way, I didn't want to feel like public television, which was, I didn't want there to be a cut to me sitting there in my class with the clipboard nodding as the questions were being answered, because we just didn't need to see that. Thank you. That's the laugh I was looking for. Thank you, Mark. But also, I thought I didn't want that thing where people were talking about black experience in the abstract. I didn't want there to be scholars. In 1946, after this happened, or after the Board Brown versus Board of Education decision, I thought that kind of thing was immaterial, because we know where to find that. I thought it was much more effective to have people talk about their own lives. That makes it personal. That shows that each person comes from a different background and saw a way through and couldn't be slowed by whatever obstacles are thrown up against them. And to have two films, Faye Waddleton to Valerie Montgomery Rice, from the RZA to Colin Powell, if we're talking about the enormity and the range of black culture, from Slash at the beginning to Charlie Pride at the end, I mean, that is the way, the most effective way I can possibly think of to say the black experience is a lot more than we think it is. And I have to say, I find myself as surprised by these interviews as anybody else.
I want to give people a taste of this. So let's go to a track from the first, from Blacklist Volume 1. And this is Susan Laurie Parks, who's an American playwright and screenwriter, MacArthur Genius Award winner. And she won the Pulitzer Prize for drama for Top Dog, Underdog. Let's just hear this short clip.
Often in the black community, the audience feels that they are an active participant and they have to, go on, sister, you tell them, that kind of thing. As if it's happening, you know, in their living room. We have to mine those riches more and celebrate those riches more. I think a lot of times we forget who we are. My father was in the army, 2 tours in Vietnam and 1 tour in Korea, and very rarely talked about the war. I remember when we traveled, when he was reassigned from, say, California to Kentucky, or from Kentucky to North Carolina, he would dress in his army uniform, because if you dressed in your army uniform, the folks on the road were less likely to kill you. That's how dangerous it was. But these stories, very few and far between, and only told to me when I, like, was in my 30s.
She is so alive.
She is. And the thing we're missing from this, but just playing these clips, even though, God, I was shocked at how well it works in this context, is we're missing the astonishingly beautiful photography of Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who shot all these people, and everybody looks spectacular. And it's also one of these things that you're kind of not aware of until you watch the movie, is how often we're badly photographed in film. And Timothy is an incredibly talented photographer who's been making his living at this for over 30 years and knows how to light people so that there's a graphic vitality that comes across as well. And these things just kind of demand to be seen, because not only is she alive in that audio track, but, you know, her eyes are dancing in the light, and you see these beautiful tats up and down her arms, and the way she leans into the camera and makes a point. It's not just people sitting there, you know, shot from a left angle looking into the camera, but as they talk and they come to life, they gesture, and there's a real just kind of force of life in these films that you don't often see in interviews, and that's important too in the way they're framed by Timothy.
Now, that's interesting. I mean, his work, Timothy Greenfield Sanders, I think that there's a lot of layers to that which you just described. I mean, because he did capture people in a really very beautiful way in both films, and there's also something that you know just from film, period, that there are a lot of people, especially a lot of, get people angry with this, but there are a lot of people, especially a lot of white cinematographers, who have issues with lighting black people in a certain way. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, completely. Well, you know, if you go back, there's a German cinematographer, Karl Freund, who shot German Expressionist film, who talks about how the old silver nitrates film stock was made for really pale people. You know, so there's a different consideration in lighting white people, who were the majority of film subjects and still are, than there are for African Americans. And there's a kind of a sensitivity that demands an eye, the exercise of taste, all those things that Timothy has. But I should not only say that, but most of the films were shot at Timothy's studio, which is also his home. He lives in a converted rectory in the East Village. And that place did a lot of the work for us, because instead of having to sit in the studio and, like, you know, drink a lukewarm cup of decaf and read a copy of Highlights for Children while you go in, they came to Timothy's place and saw this beautiful home that's a reflection of his sensibility. He has his art there and photographs he's taken, and then worked by other photographers too. So that made people a lot more relaxed. So when they sat down for the hour-long interviews that I had with them, there was a different kind of conversation that we had. And the other thing that we got too, which maybe goes unspoken but needs to be said, is being African-American myself, I kind of know what it's like to be black. So I didn't have to go, so what's it like to be black? That weird question people know where to look when it gets asked of them. And there was kind of a compact between me and the subjects, I think, made things a lot easier. And I have to say, for even the second volume, where a few people hadn't seen the first film, there was still this sense of discovery because I didn't go in with any preconceptions. There was no list of questions that I used. I treated everybody differently and did all the research. And as a result, my idea, and I'm sure you hold this too, that an interview really gets good was when you can hear the surprise in the subject's voice. That's when you know that it's going somewhere that they hadn't expected, and you as well. And that's where the fun comes in.
And talking about film, in the second, in volume two, Susan DePass, that was a very interesting interview.
And my God, it certainly is, because I met Suzanne years ago, and I just remember saying this to her, God, probably like in 95 or 96 when I first met her, you realize you are the only African-American woman who has ever been nominated for a screenwriting award. That's a nomination she shared with several people for Lady Sings the Blues. But at that point, it was going on 15 years. Now it's 30 years, and that's still the case. There still is yet to be another African-American woman nominated for a screenwriting Oscar. I mean, that's an auspicious and almost dubious kind of achievement, at least on the behalf of the Academy, and filmmaking in the mainstream in general. And this is the thing that gets to what I thought these movies were. I just thought that I'm a film critic, but first and foremost, I'm an African-American audience member, and I know what I have not seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that these films, if it was just people speaking directly into the camera, and each story having a beginning, a middle, and an end, no cutting back and forth, so we create this artificial conversation about certain topics. And I held to these things, and there were arguments about it. And I just said, also, I can't be in this because these aren't my stories. And it also violates that rule I was telling you about, that I said that there shouldn't be anybody in here who's not talking about something that they've experienced. And you can, you know, those are almost always the first people that turn up on CNN and MSNBC, you know, the kind of scholars who write the books. You know, you expect to see them. And I've even heard from a few people kind of go, yeah, you know, it's great to see a movie and not see the kind of usual suspects you get in movies about the African-American experience. The purpose was to try to defeat as many of those preconceptions about both our culture and in documentaries about us as possible, because I can tell you I go to the Sundance Film Festival every year for the last 10 years, and almost all the documentaries are about black victimhood, about people who cannot get through a competently managed day without some kind of social welfare infrastructure. And I know I'm just tired of seeing those movies. I knew there had to be something else, a way to deal with African-American achievement and ambition without sentimentalizing it.
And I think we're moving into that era. I got a feeling things are changing that way. I'm gonna come back and explore that through the voices of some of the people that we find in Blacklist Volume 2. We're talking to Elvis Mitchell, who produced that. He, along with Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who shot it and produced it with him, will be here tomorrow night at the Brown Center at MICA as part of the OSI Baltimore series talking about race. It'll be at 7 p.m. tomorrow. They'll both be there to take your questions and to talk with you all after you watch the film itself. We'll come right back with our conversation with Elvis Mitchell. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. We will be right back with Elvis Mitchell. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Film Festival that runs from May 7th through 10th. It's the region's premier film event, over 130 films of all types from all over the world with filmmakers and other surprises. Film for everyone. For all details and purchase tickets, you can guarantee you can get them and see the movies that you want. Go to MarylandFilmFest.com. That's MDFilmFest.com. Right now, we're talking about another film, and we're talking about with the filmmaker himself, Elvis Mitchell, former film critic for the New York Times, host of KCRW's The Treatment. He produced the documentary series The Blacklist, Volumes 1 and 2. Volume 2 will be shown tomorrow night at the Brown Center at MICA at 7 p.m. as part of OSI Baltimore series talking about race. He'll be there with Timothy Greenfield Sanders to introduce the film and take all of your questions. You can go to osi-baltimore.org for more information or join us here right now at 410-319-8888 to talk with Elvis Mitchell. So when we left off, I don't want to belabor this because there's so many of the people I want to bring up, but we were talking about Susan DePass, and I was thinking about the lack, the dearth of women, of African-American women in the film industry as writers and that perspective. And I was thinking, you know, there was Juliette Dash who did Daughters of the Dust.
Right. And it's Cheryl Dunye who did Watermelon Woman.
Yes.
There's Darnell Martin who did I Like It Like That, I guess about 1994 or 5. And this year, well, last year rather, directed Cadillac Records, but I think made only one film in that kind of 12-year period between I Like It Like That and Cadillac Records, and the paucity of opportunities for African-American women. And Chris Rock, if you recall, even talks about that in Volume 1. He said what he's waiting to see is the female version of Tyler Perry, and he knows it's out there somewhere, and he can't wait to work with her himself. So there is a hunger even in the African-American filmmaking community for that kind of voice that is still, I'm sure, out there in the wilderness waiting to be called in and invited to the table and contribute to the conversation that we're talking about.
We talked at the very beginning of the program about Valerie Montgomery Rice, who is president of Meharry Medical School.
Growing up, one of my mother's closest friends was a nurse who studied at Meharry, and the way she talked about Meharry is like it was a calling. It wasn't just going to college, and it wasn't just going to medical school even, or nursing school in her case. It was something you did because you knew that you'd been called upon in some way, and you had to give something back to the community. And I knew that getting somebody from Meharry to come talk about it, because we always hear about the Ivy League schools and that being a kind of a pinnacle of achievement for African Americans. And that's the thing I think that's almost been forgotten, is that Meharry has this incredible and noble tradition of instilling an altruism in its graduates that I think carries through to this very day, as Dr. Meharry talked about. On the other hand, she was just so impish, and she talked about being the cutest thing and hating the idea of getting stuff on her suit because she knew how cute she looked. And I just want to get that sparkle in her eye and just sort of say that, you know, this is this young African-American woman who knew she was a hottie when she was 18 and 19 years old and 22 and, you know, but still was pulled into math and the physical sciences, and, you know, again, just somebody who kind of thwarts all these perceptions you might have if you were just to look at her simply as, you know, as your friend might say, as stats, as just like numbers and facts on a page, and getting people a chance to talk about their own lives and just to kind of bring that kind of breath of fresh air that comes from really hard-won knowledge of yourself is key to the films as well.
That's a very important message and a very important presence, I think, that she served in this film. And let me pick somebody else here. This could be controversial for some people, but I really enjoyed Maya Rudolph as well.
Daughter. Why do you think controversial?
Well, because there's still so many people, I mean, even during the election, people talked about, is Obama black enough? They said it from the white side and the black side.
Sure.
In the beginning, especially, and the things began to change. But when she made the statement, I don't feel she doesn't have to declare what race she is, that she is all the things that she embodies.
It's an incredibly, as you're saying, it's an incredibly complicated thing. And as you talk about this, you're reminding me, you give me a lot to think about that hadn't occurred to me before, some of the links between the two films. When in Volume 1, Susan Rice talks about the same thing, because the day we caught her happened to be the day that Obama was being attacked by Jesse Jackson, who was questioning his bona fides as a black man, you know, and he wasn't alone in doing that. And she said, well, when are we going to get past this kind of old think of, because your mother is white or your father is white, that you're not black enough? When are we going to get past that old think? And she was completely right. And so for Maya, it still shocks me how many people didn't know she's Minnie Riperton's daughter. Oops, I gave away the shock ending of the film tomorrow. But go see it anyway.
Oh, damn.
I think there's a couple other surprises left.
But, there are a few.
But when she talks about the basically defining herself as herself And these things that make her the building blocks of Maya Rudolph, the fact that she's attracted to acting, that she found herself in playing other people. I mean, I think that's as interesting a story as anything else. And that these questions are still going on. You've been asking a lot of great stuff because you really got me thinking about the way these films connect and that in the way that I hadn't thought about, they're both kind of part of a piece. I thought them as being kind of separate entities until now.
They are part of a piece. And then we're going to open the phone chair again, but let me jump onto somebody else's, RZA. If I'm right, he starts the film off. He's one of the first two, right? Or does he start it off?
Yeah, he's second. The first is the artist Carol Walker.
That's right, Carol Walker, excuse me. Who also was amazing. But we'll talk about her.
Yeah, she tells a great story about. She tells one of my favorite guys, giving the film away. But she says, if you're a black artist and you have a whole wall that's nothing but a sea of smiling faces, somebody will say, "Why are you so angry?" I mean, it's just that kind of reductionist thinking that still is there.
Because it was just important to have said everything in this movie that you've done. I want you to take out and make an hour long discussion on the air. Because this conceptually, the whole idea about why do people look at black folks who are artists and always or writers or painters or whatever the art form may be, and say you have to be angry, that there can't be a subtleness and a beauty about stuff, then always has to be this kind of visceral anger that everybody expects.
Well, yeah, and you think about the kind of artistic contributions we made to this culture and to this planet. And how much of that is rooted in anger? Not a lot. I mean, a lot of it's about that thing you're talking about finding the beauty in yourself and finding a way to express that artistically. I mean, that's what makes an artist, to find a way to define what beauty is for you and put it out there for the world. And your definition of beauty changing the world because it is so profound and singular and unique to you. And it's great when somebody says something like that, somebody who is as celebrated and as interesting as Kara, who is really just a real force in the art world, is she gets that kind of thing too. And certainly the stuff she's doing now is definitely deals with racial politics, but it had not always been that way. And so for her to talk about that, I thought was kind of key to one of the many things we're doing. Thank you so much for bringing that up.
Let me play another clip. This is, again, from the first. We don't have clips from the second film.
That's because we want people to go see it.
I understand. There's a logic to that. That's fine. That's good. I want them to see it. I want them all to turn out tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Mica Center, the Brown Center, 7 p.m. Be there. I will be there to say hello to you. Not that makes you want to come, but you should go anyway.
Just go to, I'm leaving now. Okay, I got to go. I got to go make a train. I'll see you.
Bye. osi-baltimore.org. And make sure you go. It's an incredible series that OSI is starting on race, and this is kicks it off. But let's hear Faye Waddleton from the first film.
A lot of women suffered and sacrificed an enormous amount to make it possible for women today to have choices in their personal lives. I'm really sorry that my daughter didn't have an opportunity to grow up in a segregated African-American community, as I did in the early years of my life in St. Louis, where the lawyer lived next to the house painter, lived next to the doctor, lived next to the preacher, and we were all together. That can have an enormously powerful influence on the community and the value of keeping and raising our children properly. I think a lot of that has broken down with integration. As we have dispersed, as we've become a more mobile population, we don't take the kind of ownership pride that I saw in my growing up. Actually, when I think about my life and what has happened in my career and my calling, the things that I've been called to do, which I consider to be privileges,